This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. The government has taken the unprecedented step of writing to every mosque in the country to tell Muslim leaders they must do more to root out the men of hate who are preaching extremism. Eric Pickles, the community's secretary, has written to over 1,000 imams and other Islamic leaders, urging them to tell young Muslims they should be proud to be British. Whitehall is unable to defeat jihadist ideology alone. Muslim leaders have a responsibility to prevent young men and women from being radicalised, is contained in the letter that was sent out on Friday. Let's speak with Lord Ahmed of Wimbledon, who is a communities minister, who joins me now. What are you hoping to achieve with that letter, Lord Ahmed?
Well, good morning, Nick.
Morning, sir.
What we're looking to do, I mean, the letter focuses on sort of three key issues. First of all, was the unequivocal condemnation from across the board, all communities, all faiths, and the Muslim community was part and parcel of this at the front line, on the front foot, demonstrably showing the rejection and the unequivocal condemnation of those heinous crimes we saw in Paris. Secondly, was a level of reassurance. Both myself and Eric Pickles have engaged extensively, along with Theresa May, with communities, both the Muslim community and the Jewish community, about possible, you know, the reprisals from the attacks. And we've been working very closely with the police. And the letter also gives that, underlines that reassurance. And the third element, which you focused in on the introduction, was how we can work together to get rid of and eradicate this extremism. Time and time again, and I'm a Muslim myself, this has nothing to do with Islam, it has nothing to do with faith, and the people who carry out these crimes are criminals, and we need to be loud and clear in eradicating this from our society. And we want to, as the letter says quite clearly, work with all communities to ensure we eradicate this and work together with the Muslim community to address these issues, you know, sort of front on. And there's no other way of dealing with it.
Yes. How will you know what the letter might achieve?
Well, you don't, do you? When you send out a letter, you send it out on the basis that I've outlined. I'm disappointed by the response of the Muslim Council of Britain on this. They said about we have to restate somehow Muslim values with British values. Well, the letter's quite explicit. There's a paragraph which says British values are Muslim values. It reads, we believe together we have an opportunity to demonstrate the true nature of British Islam today. In the letter, both Eric and I thank explicitly the Muslim community for what they're doing, but we also are responding to what the Muslim communities tell them ourselves, that we need to work collaboratively on this to ensure that we address the root out the real causes of extremism. And I fully accept this is not just about the imams. We see issues on the internet, for example, and we're working closely with the Muslim community on that. We have an initiative called Imams Online to counter the extremist narrative, positive elements of the Muslim community coming out explicitly saying, not in our name, and we need to hear more of that.
Lord Ahmed, hold on the line, if you would, because I have someone from the Muslim Council of Britain, just to illustrate those points a little more for my listeners. Welcome to the conversation, Harun Khan, who's Deputy Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain. You have concerns over this letter, I understand, Mr. Khan. What are they? Good morning.
Good morning. I mean, firstly, on behalf of the Muslim Council of Britain, I think just to reiterate that in terms of condemnation of terrorism and, you know, violent acts, we've been consistent throughout many years condemning these acts. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the comments, to be fair, our response in the media was in response to a request from the BBC yesterday as to what Eric Pickles was quoted as saying. Mm-hmm. With regard to mosques. Now, us being a national umbrella organisation representing around 500 mosques and Islamic organisations, we haven't seen this letter. No one in government has actually spoken to us. In fact, the community secretary, who's been in position for more than 4 years, hasn't really engaged with us.
I don't understand. If you are a representative of 500 mosques, why wouldn't one of the imams there let you have sight of the letter?
Well, I mean, I think if the letter is making reference to leaders of the community, so obviously we're not seen as leaders of the community, and you know, we've not been privy to this information, so we can only comment on things that we haven't seen.
We're talking on
a second-hand basis.
But
Mr. Khan, the letter, then we would have the right to respond.
But Mr. Khan, respectfully, sir, surely this issue is of such import that whether you were or whether you were not, or whether you were accidentally omitted from the list of who should be in receipt of the letter, it falls to you and the Council of Britain, the Muslim Council of Britain, to go to a mosque and get... not to row about whether they sent you a letter, to talk about what the letter's actually intending to achieve.
It just reinforces the viewpoint that mosques are the problem. But in our view, mosques are actually the solution. You know, mosques are not the ones where extremism is breeding.
That's why I have to reflect. You're at the front line here, so that's why I ask you. So you think, in a way, I mean, I think this is perhaps more germane than whether or not you received a letter, frankly. You think, in fact, that writing to mosque is a bit of a fruitless exercise.
It is. It's not just fruitless, Nick. I think the key point is that a letter of this nature, in this public nature, is implying that there is an issue with the mosques and extremism is breeding there. That is not the case. I think, you know, we've done so much in the last 2 weeks since the attacks in Paris in terms of not only condemnation, we've held meetings, we've had interfaith groups, we've met with Jewish leaders, you know, giving our solidarity towards them in terms of what we can do collectively. And I think that's the right approach.
All right, stay on the line if you would. Let me bring Lord Ahmad, a communities minister, back into the conversation. What about this idea that perhaps the mosques aren't the problem, Lord? They are actually the solution.
Well, I agree with that. You know,
Why write to them then?
No, why we're writing with them is because the Muslim community says to us time and time again, I'm a Muslim myself, about how we can work together collaboratively into addressing the issues of extremism. I think it's somewhat naive of the MCB to start criticising our letter without seeing it. And as you rightly pointed out, this has gone directly to imams because we believe that working directly with people who may come across people, youngsters who may be misguided or are being, turning to an extremist ideology because of what they see on the internet. One of the first people they will go to is the imam. One of the first people they'll go to for clarification of what Islam says is the imam. So we have to deal with people and work together with them. There's them and us. As the letter says from both Eric and I, British values are Muslim values. And right at the end of the letter, and this is something that the MCB should also respond to if they feel so strongly about it, we've said, and quite clearly, I don't know how more explicit, Nick, we can get, we said we welcome your thoughts, ideas and initiatives on how to ensure that Islam's true message of peace triumphs over those who seek to divide our communities. Thank you for your positive work and we look forward to working with you and continuing to work with you in the future. Our position in government is very clear. We welcome people who are on the front line, who are dealing with these issues day to day. At one point we're hearing from the MCB that mosques are in the front line and they're part of the solution, and then they're saying don't write to them.
Well, let's put that now, just hold on the line if you would. That would seem a very good point, Haran Khan, Deputy Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain. It may be that I'm going to say young men, they normally are radicalised over the internet, but then they seek out an imam. That is the importance, surely, of this letter.
It's not, Nick. I mean, I'm somebody who's born and brought up in this country, OK? I've been to mosques throughout my entire life from a young age, and also I'm also part of a mosque management as well, locally in my area. We haven't seen the letter. And anyway, it's not just the letter itself. I think the key point is that we're saying actually young people aren't going to imams for help. Because of the constant legislation and the clampdown on mosques and imams over the number of years through anti-terrorism, imams aren't allowed to speak out. What is it that young people want to say? They want to talk about issues that they have. They've got anger, they've got issues around foreign policy. You know, we hear this many times.
That's exactly what this letter's about, isn't it?
Yeah, but the point is...
If I suddenly present myself, I change my identity, I discover Islam and I'm a real problem and I go to my nearest mosque, that's exactly what the government's driving at. They need to be told by the nearest mosque to Blackheath. I don't know where it would be.
They won't do it.
Well, they must, respectfully, they must do it. Surely, that's what this letter's about.
No, they won't, because they know that it'll be treated as a suspect way of doing things. So if it comes from the government in this way, to mosques, etc., that basically if you come to us, then... You know, it's almost like, you know, you're being watched.
All right, last word, I think, must go to the Communities Minister, Lord Ahmad. Good intent, but I fear you might be knocking on a closed door briefly, Lord.
No, Ahmad. I don't. You know, when you have noble intent, perseverance is the key. And he talked about young men. Only recently we've seen what a great man Aamir Khan is, who stands for Britain, who wears the flag on his heart, on his sleeve, whatever, on his boxing glove. And what did he say? I'm proud to be Muslim, I'm proud to be British, and when my religion is hijacked by fanatics, I stand up to fight against that. And I think that's what we want to see more of.
I must leave it there, Lord Ahmed, your community minister. I think you mean Amir Khan as the boxer to whom you're referring. Thank you. And thank you also, I'm sorry, Harun Khan, thank you, Deputy Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain. A letter. Is it enough? To other news, if you've got a diesel car, get ready to pay more to park, at least in one London borough, for that parking pass that you need. It's in Islington, where it's been announced that they reckon more than 9,000 diesel car drivers will pay an extra £100 each year for the privilege of parking outside their home. It's effectively a diesel tax. I think it comes in later this year. Councillor Claudia Webb is Executive Member for the Environment at Islington Council, joins me now. What's the thinking behind this, Councillor? Good morning.
Well, good morning, Nick. Our difficulty here is the public health issues that are associated with diesel vehicles. Our concern is nitrogen dioxide and particulate matters, where these are considered to be harmful to health. Diesels, if you like, have been almost proven to cause much of this problem when it comes to these pollutants, and are causing the health problems of our residents, causing cancer and other heart issues like heart and lung diseases and other health and long-term issues, and even death in Islington. So our issue is to try to tackle these problems by tackling the most polluting vehicles, and that has proven to us to be diesel vehicles.
Now,
and we want to provide a useful deterrent.
Is it fair to bring it in retrospectively? How fair is that? That is to say, it wasn't that long ago that central government and City Hall was urging people to buy diesel cars. Now it's been found that that decision was wrong. Indeed, Boris Johnson, the mayor, has apologised a number of occasions on this programme for information. It wasn't on his watch, but he appreciates people went out, bought diesel cars. Now, they're not easy to change. Why should people do that when they were actually following a guidance?
Yeah, well, it's unfortunate in a sense for vehicle owners that have been lured into buying diesel cars as being sort of more healthier, more safer than petrol vehicles, but the evidence base is not there for that.
No, we know now.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Let's go to the first caller, Peter. Peter in West Hampstead. Hello, Peter.
Yes, hello, Nick.
Hello.
It's about the Chilcot inquiry, which is the most brazen, the most disgraceful and most scandalous cover-up I've ever come across in all my life. What can we, the public, do to help you campaign to get this report released in 28 days?
I wish I could tell you, Peter. I'm slightly at my wit's end. I mean, the vote to go into that fateful war was taken in March 2003. And of course, I, vividly remember the way that all the Labour and Conservative MPs who voted for it, including, by the way, David Cameron, vociferously condemned the Liberal Democrats for standing out against it. And it's now 12 years later, we still don't have an explanation for how those decisions were arrived at, who took the decisions, on what basis, and so on. I wish I could tell you how we could get this published in 28 days. It's clearly not going to happen, because Sir John Chilcot said it's not going to happen. I don't know. This is the point. None of us really know why those delays have come about. There's endless speculation left, right and centre. But kind of, at the end of the day, as your kind of question implies, it's not really our job to constantly worry about, who said what to whom in an independent process over which we've got no control. I just feel so incredibly sorry for the families who've lost loved ones and are asking, why did my son or daughter lose their life, and what were the reasons that their political masters took to send them into harm's way? I just forget the politics for a minute. What about them? They deserve more quick answers. And look, there's apparently now, final point on this, Peter, there's apparently now this process going on, which is in the jargon called Maxwellisation. So he or the Chilcot panel, they write, and this is totally legitimate and understandable, write to those who are going to be subject to criticism and allow those people a right of reply. I don't think anyone would begrudge them that right, and that clearly must happen. But, you know, once that's done, and I hope that's done as quickly as possible, if there's any question that, I don't know, that the panel doesn't have the necessary resources then to move very rapidly to actually publishing the final report, I certainly want to see, you know, government provide any resources that would be necessary in order to then get the job done in the quickest way possible so that there are no further excuses for delay left.
Peter, response from you.
Well, I think that if the government tells Chilcot that this is a damn disgrace, then Chilcot would publish it tomorrow. Well, I think it's...
Yeah, well, you say that, Peter, but I mean, I don't think I could have been clearer about my own dismay and actually anger, on, but certainly on behalf of the families, that this delay is just going on and on and on. It's just interminable. But look, it's an independent panel, of course, that, which is what you'd want, Peter, wouldn't you? You wouldn't want it run by politicians. So, you know, at the end of the day, they got to get a move. I'm just totally nonplussed, to put it mildly, that they got themselves into this situation where 12 years after that vote, we still don't really know. We haven't had the lid lifted on how those decisions. And by the interesting thing, of course, is people like Tony Blair. You know, he is saying, look, that from his point of view, he wants it out as quickly. And I can kind of, you know, we might come at this argument from opposite sides as far as the decision to go to war. But oddly enough, it's in the interest of those who are going to be criticised, apparently, that this report should be published as quickly as possible.
He says he's not a drag on publication. Do you believe him?
Yeah, listen, I've got no reason to disbelieve. I take what most people say most of the time on good faith. And look, he clearly believes, and he said after all these years in politics, he said when he gave evidence to the inquiry that, you know, he believed the decision he took was right, etc., etc., etc. I totally disagree with that, but I believe I believe what he says, that he wants it out there so that he can sort of restate his case.
What about this idea and Prime Minister's questions yesterday, Deputy Prime Minister, from, I think, a Conservative MP, that Sir John should appear before a panel of MPs or appear somewhere to sort of explain and answer a few questions, not necessarily confrontational, but just there is... I have to tell you, the calls we've taken, there's you agree with that?
Of course I do. As a general principle, I think when people, however distinguished or whoever they are asked by a select committee of the House of Commons to come and, you know, give evidence on something which is of enormous public interest, they should do so. And look, I have to accept, through gritted teeth, that this report, which we've been waiting for, you know, for years... And do you remember when Gordon Brown announced this? I'm not sure if people remember this. When he announced it in 2009...
He said it'd take 12 months.
He said it'd be published before the last election. Not even before published the next one. I'm just sort of... I'm reconciled to the idea that it's not going to be published at any time soon, certainly not before the next general election. But it seems to me that Sir John Chilcot, having kind of dropped this bombshell on everybody, does at least need to provide a bit, you know, of a fuller explanation. As I said in my letter to him, if you don't provide an explanation, of course, people are going to start assuming the worst. They're going to start assuming that the report is going to put its punches, or it's going to be, as I put it, sex down.
Yeah,
you know, that's what happens. If you leave a vacuum, a vacuum gets filled, quite understandably, with the worst suspicions. So it's not actually in the interests of the report, of the panel, and of Sir John Chilcot's own work, to allow all this speculation to run riot without explanation.
And as a seasoned and senior politician, this will make your heart sink. The day that your letter broke in the news, we had a phone in here on LBC, and so many people, particularly young people, phoned, tweeted, texted and emailed and say, why do we bother voting? Why do we bother voting if they treat us like this? And that's pretty ugly, because I know you will, in a few weeks, and all your colleagues will be urging everyone to vote, but they look at something like this, Deputy Prime Minister, and they say, why?
Well, I mean, by the way, actually, you could flip the argument the other way around. If you think the way that things are done in the kind of established way, and you want it changed, for heaven's sake, get stuck in there and vote. I'm not going to repeat, we've talked about it before in this programme, my own frustrations at the sort of slightly clapped out way in which we do politics in this country. I did my bit to try and change it. People didn't choose to support the changes I pushed on party funding reform, votes to the House of Lords, changing the voting system and so on. But, you know, that'll come back up again. And in a sense, if people become more and more impatient with change and to change the way in which the sort of establishment run things, that is all, you know, that's music to my ears as a sort of reformist liberal. But on this particular issue, I do think we're in the worst of all worlds now, which is people are dismayed and angry. that families are deeply upset, and we've been told it's not going to be published anytime soon, and yet no one really understands why.
We better move on. Peter, thank you for your call. To another caller, where do we go, Deputy Prime Minister?
Sheila in Purley. Hello, Sheila. Sheila.
Good morning, Mr. Clegg.
Morning.
Now, my question is, why are we giving all these billions and billions in foreign aid when we know it's mired in corruption, when our own country needs this money, when you think of the forces are being cut, the police, A&Es are closing, the schools, some schools are teaching foreign students, 25 different languages, and immigration. Mm. Now, I'm older than you, Mr. Clegg. Mm. I'm nearly 80, mm-hmm. and I can remember disasters in this country going back 60 years. Mm. And we know that foreign aid is mired in corruption, and it has been for years. No government has ever done anything about it. There's no checks and balances, and quite frankly, I pay taxes. And people I've spoken to over the last two years about this, and it used to be Afghanistan, foreign aid, and immigration.
Sheila, excuse me interrupting, but just to clarify, I want to keep you on the line. You're asking, would you stop it altogether, or you just want it radically cut, so I can put your question to the Deputy Prime Minister?
Foreign aid.
Yeah.
No, I think it should be drastically
cut. Stay on the line.
Yeah,
Mr. Clegg.
Sheila, you're not alone.
It's about 11 point something billion, just to remind the listeners.
So in terms of how much do we spend on all this? We spend now 0.7% of everything, our national wealth we devote to helping countries elsewhere in the world. I think you and I are just going to have to agree to disagree when it comes to the massive humanitarian efforts that we conduct around the world. I think it's I think it should be a source of pride for us that when we see people starving, terrorised by conflict, on the edge of absolute destitution, that we lead the world in rushing to those parts of the world to try and help them. So, for instance, our humanitarian operation in Syria is the largest we've ever launched, hundreds of millions of pounds. Yes, that is British taxpayers' money, but I like to believe that most people think that our humanitarian instinct is a good one. On what I call not emergency humanitarian relief, but aid more generally. Yes, I think you're right, Sheila, in saying we should be very vigilant and the money just doesn't end up in corrupt pockets, and I accept that's an ongoing challenge. I actually think we've done a huge amount to make sure that the transparency of aid, that you can actually now, as a member of the public, go online and have a look online where aid is going, to whom, for what purposes. We've got people crawling over all the projects to make sure they're being well spent on the ground. They don't end up being sort of filtered away into the clammy hands of dodgy bosses and political despots and so on. But here's the point, Sheila, which I mean, I'm not sure if I succeed in persuading you, but I do think it's worth remembering that helping other countries to help their own people. It's not just a sort of altruistic sort of charitable thing to do. It actually makes sense for us because the kind of things that
the
does
Ethiopian
affect
Ethiopian Spice Girls.
Well,
how the
this
hell
is, this
does that
is this
make
is
sense
the case you
us?
Raised before. I must look into the Ethiopian Spice Girls.
Yanga, actually, I'll write it out.
Well,
for
as,
you.
As it happens, as it happens, I visited some of the projects that we fund in Ethiopia for instance, make sure that to make sure that Ethiopian girls get a good education. That they look after their health, that they they get a full role in society. And
with
the reason
the
why that
girls.
Is in our interest, the reason why that's in our interest is if their societies are more stable, if their societies are more healthy and are economically stronger, then fewer people will move vast distances to try and illegally migrate from one continent to the other, and there's less likelihood that you're going to get the conflicts that end up on our doorstep. Anyway, and that's why I just do think it's worth remembering. Yes, I think it's the right thing to do anyway. It's also actually in our own interest to try and create a more stable world around us.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
A 6-year-long inquiry into the 2003 Iraq invasion and its aftermath will not be published before the general election. One man, and I sense he's not alone, is angry. It's Nick Clegg, of course, Lib Dem leader, Deputy Prime Minister. We go back to the call, Clegg, in December when Mr. Clegg explained why there was a delay in its release.
First, the sheer volume of material. Millions and millions and millions of documents. They've been given unfettered, totally unrestricted access to every single piece of documentation, however secret, however confidential. So they've been sifting through that. But then there's this process, which I guess is just, you know, isn't common sense dictates is just a fair process, is that those individuals, so the politicians of the, particularly the politicians of the day in the Labour government of the day, that decided on our behalf, in my view, catastrophically and very wrongly, to go to war in Iraq, that those individuals who are in any way criticised or commented upon have a right, which is fair enough, to reply.
Wouldn't it be helpful if, for the purpose of debate, we said it will come out in February? It has to come out this side of the election, doesn't it?
Well, I certainly think it should do, absolutely. I'd be very disappointed if it didn't.
Let's speak with another Lib Dem heavy hitter. Tim Farron is the party's foreign affairs spokesperson and joins me now. What does this do for public confidence in this area, Mr. Farron? Good morning to you.
Good morning. I don't think it does very much for public confidence. We bear in mind that Gordon Brown kicked off this inquiry in 2009, saying it should be done within a year. 6 years on, we're still waiting. So not just one, but two general elections will have passed without people whose lives very much affected by the decision to go to war in Iraq having any chance to hold the people responsible to account. And it doesn't strike me that this is ancient history at all. This is something which is very live today. I would argue, as I know Nick Clegg has as well, that the decision to go to war in Iraq has put all of us at greater risk. The unilateral or bilateral decision between the United States and the United Kingdom back in the last decade to go into what I would consider to be an illegal war in Iraq has meant that many people in the Middle East now see the West as aggressors and ourselves as aggressors rather than friends and allies. And that has made all of us less safe and has caused huge problems that we're still trying to live with today.
You're close to the corridors of power, Mr. Farron. What do you understand to be the blockage?
Well, my understanding is, as Nick rightly said, those people who are named in the report have a right to challenge what is said about them. But we're 6 years down the line, and it's now getting beyond ridiculous that we have a situation that people who potentially are criticised are, one might assume, and the public might assume, trying to do one of two things, or maybe both. First of all, to soften and weaken the criticism made against them in the report, and secondly, to kick it into the long grass so that when it does come out, we're nowhere near an election. And there are key people, and I'm not saying these people are going to be named and shamed in any way, but key people like, for example, Jack Straw and Gordon Brown, who are very senior players at the time of the decision to go to war in Iraq, who retire as MPs this spring. I think it's wrong that people like that will not be held to account when they are on the highest political stage when this report finally comes out. And the people who lost loved ones in the Iraq conflict, people who served in the Iraq conflict, and all of us today living with heightened insecurity because of a foolish and reckless decision, I would say an illegal decision, to go to war in Iraq alongside George W. Bush, have the right to know the truth.
If I was the subject of some form of employment proceedings or tribunal here at this radio station, I wouldn't necessarily expect to have sight of whatever the human resources team had decided to do with me, what other evidence might have been put by some of the colleagues who worked with me and had various complaints. Why is it that we have this, I sometimes see it called maxwellisation or salmonisation, why is it we allow this, Mr. Farron?
Well, that is a very good question, and I understand why, you know, when the report comes out, it must be seen to have been fair and rigorous and balanced. So I understand that is why they've allowed people whose names we all know.
It doesn't preclude it from being rigorous and balanced just because you don't show it to someone, does it, Mr. Farron?
Well, I guess if something is said about you and against you, natural justice dictates that you have a right to challenge that.
But I could be fired from my job with that. I appreciate your support of getting this out there. You're sort of very kindly defending it for me, because I think you think it stinks
from
the head.
I don't particularly want to defend it.
I think you think it stinks from the head down as well. But yes. I mean, if this was here, I wouldn't expect to see all the evidence that they're getting rid of me on. Do you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm driving at?
Yeah, I do. And I think the danger is that we may be seeing, and the public may perceive, I've got to be careful what I say here, that some of those involved, some of these very key, well-known establishment figures from the last government, may be seen to be using what is a fair and open process to kick this into the long grass and avoid scrutiny. And that is so very, very wrong. I mean, at the time of the Iraq war, even though the evidence was presented as accurate at the time, many of us, and the Liberal Democrats led by Charles Kennedy at the time, were absolutely clear that this was a huge mistake. It was morally wrong, legally wrong, and would in all practical terms be counterproductive to Britain's interests. And that was before it became clear that the evidence presented to the House of Commons was potentially at least faulty. There are many people here who have much to fear from things coming out, not least David Cameron, because, of course, Conservatives voted for the Iraq war too. And the job of an opposition, which the Conservatives were at the time, is to hold governments to account and not just to sheepishly follow them through the lobby when, you know, possibly we were witnessing, and I would say probably witnessing, the worst British foreign policy disaster since Suez.
Yes, worth just dwelling on those words for a second before my final question. You mentioned David Cameron. He is, of course, the Prime Minister. My professional background, I've worked alongside people like Kelvin McKenzie, the newspaper editor, and Rupert Murdoch, the proprietor. And effectively, if you'll pardon the expression, if they bang the bloody desk, something gets done. Surely, and I know I'm going to hear that they're independent and it must be independent and there has to be distance between politicians, and if he banged a desk loud enough, this would be published, wouldn't it, Mr. Farron?
Well, you've made your case very strongly, and I would like to think that would have been the case. But of course, it's an independent.
Is an independent speak for yes?
It is an independent inquiry. I think the reality
Come on,
is
the
now.
The Prime Minister starts banging desks, things happen.
I think the issue is the desks should have been banged a year, 2 years ago. Mm. I think we don't want to be in a situation where we're forcing out an incomplete inquiry report now, which could then mean that the report is delegitimised and people who are criticised in it would then end up getting off scot-free. I think the failure potentially was that this was not made more of from number 10 maybe a couple of years ago. But the critical thing here is what this does for public confidence. Right. And the public will assume that very important people at the top of British politics now and then are benefiting from something being kicked into the long grass.
And I will leave it there, Tim Farron. Thank you, Foreign Affairs Spokesman. Thank you for extended time this morning, Mr. Farron, Foreign Affairs Spokesman, of course, for the Lib Dems. Mary and Croydon coming to you in just a second. You're the first up. Just to give you the timeline, we go back to 2003 for the ill-starred invasion of Iraq. As we heard, it was set up, the inquiry was set up in 2009 with the suggestion that it should report within a year. It actually took until 2011 for the final witness to give his or her evidence. So we go to 2011. After that, it was lent on again. We would like it within a year. That would take us to 2012. You can fill in the dots. Here we are. It's 2015 and still no report. Mary in Croydon.
Hello, Nick.
Hello.
I just, Tony Blair has an awful lot to answer for. At the time, the country didn't want to go to war. Why didn't he listen to... Why don't they listen to us?
Because they don't have to, sadly.
And his peace envoy, that is absolutely laughable. He was like a little lapdog running around after Bush. I'm saying, look at me, look where I am.
You know who I feel for is there will be now, before it publishes, there will be relatives, loved ones, possibly parents of soldiers who lost their lives or whose lives were altered irrevocably in the Iraq conflict, and they will go to their graves, never knowing what it actually was all about. And I think that is utterly shameful, and every politician who could have influenced this should hold his or her head in shame over this. It is absolutely wrong. Amit is in Heathrow. Amit, do you believe the Prime Minister can't do anything here?
I think the Prime Minister should exert some pressure in order for this report to be published on time, because we waited for this report for a very long time. We marched the street of London to stop this war. I believe that we paid a lot of our taxes for this war, but we don't know why. Mm. Indeed, we went to this war, and what exactly happened. Mm. We need to learn the lessons now, especially we are faced with this great danger that we have nowadays. So we need the lessons to be learned, to be understood by everybody. And
well, they can't be if it's not published, can they? You can't publish lessons you don't know.
Exactly. So we need to, the last witness, as you mentioned in your timeline, has been listened to, I think, in 2012. So that's about 2 years ago.
Well,
and until now, there is some leaks that this report needs to be shared with our allies in the States and all before it's published. we have to wait for another 3 to 5 years to find out, which is why we have to wait all of that time.
I couldn't agree more, Amit. Maintain the rage. John's in Stansted Abbott. John, how much do you think the Prime Minister could actually alter things here?
Well, he won't, because he doesn't want to. You know, if he wanted to, it would. It's one of those things where we all know it's the same old story, cover up. You know, it's all written in the lines there. You know, you can see it all behind you. Mm. Like you said before, mission accomplished. They do exactly what they set out to do. And if you think you're going to, you know, get the truth of it, you must be mistaken, because the longer time they take, the more they can cover up all the back doors, make sure it's all tied up nicely.
Yes.
So that, you know, no one knows really what's happened.
Lastly, how much confidence do you have in the establishment actually judging itself?
We've had this story so many times with all the paedophile stuff and everything else. It's all linked. It's all run by a hierarchy, which... You know, they tell us what the outcome is, and that's the end of it.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Britain will become only the second nation on Earth to introduce plain packaging for cigarettes. Laws forcing tobacco firms to sell products in standard packaging, having only grisly health warnings, will come into force next year, ministers said last night. Public Health Minister Jane Allison has said they'll have a free vote on the issue, and it's expected to be upheld by an overwhelming majority. Now, the government has been considering banning branding on packs for more than 2 years, following the example of Australia, which was the first country to introduce such laws. Some Conservative MPs have complained it makes it a nanny state. Others insist the reform will lead to increased smuggling or even job losses. Now, the medical side says that non-smokers and younger people in particular are likely to find packaging less appealing. And now it comes over to you. If you are a smoker, whether regular or just occasional or social, how important is the packaging? Would it make a blind bit of difference whether it was covered in spangly colours and marvellous graphics, or if it was just a simple piece of brown card or white paper wrapped around it? If you like smoking, surely you like smoking, don't you? I speak with Dave Bowden, who's from the Institute of Ideas. Well, what do you make of this idea, Mr. Bowden?
I think it's a hideously illiberal idea by a government who are just trying to do some cheap moral posturing and point scoring before an election, really. When you look at most of the arguments made in favour of plain packaging, a lot of it is very weak in terms of what its medical benefits will be and its overall costs to the economy. But it's ultimately just an easy way of being able to say that, you know, we are good people and we are against plain packaging. And, of course, that it's, you know, allegations of corruption are always thrown at anyone who votes against it. So I think that this is really just the sort of, you know, the next step to trying to criminalise smoking, really, in a very dishonest way.
If you look to Australia, it is reported that smoking's dropped considerably. Indeed, it's down to the lowest level since this packaging was introduced.
Well, I think that's confusing causation and correlation. I mean, obviously, smoking levels are generally dropping across societies. It's probably e-cigarettes which have had more to do with the impact of moving away from tobacco itself, which many anti-smoking people also oppose in its own terms. So I don't think you can straightforwardly say that there's an overwhelming dedication for it. I mean, just look at, you know, when you think about it yourself, very few, do you really imagine people are actually drawn to take up smoking itself because of...
What about children? What about young people, do you think?
Well, I think that the various reasons why young people are drawn to take up smoking are probably actually to do with the act itself. I think that really, when you look at the arguments around it, most of the design and advertising is about trying to attract existing smokers, really. It's a hard sell that somebody is going to be attracted by a pretty pack into something which, you know, ultimately smells and tastes quite revolting, as cigarettes do. I think that that's a really large leap to make, and it suggests a very patronising attitude behind these arguments.
You're a smoker?
I now use an e-cigarette, in fact.
So you're on e-cigarettes, okay. When you were smoking tobacco cigarettes, whatever they're called, can you recall what it was that attracted you to them? Was it peer pressure? Were you going through a difficult time in your life? What attracted you to it?
Well, I was just attracted by the concept of smoking, really. I mean, all of the reasons that people often take it up, and I sort of took it up socially, and then I, it developed into a long-term habit, which I'm glad that I've kicked now. But I also have to admit that I enjoyed very much while I was doing it, and I think that is something which can be forgotten about in these discussions. This is a perfectly legitimate activity which is engaged
No, I agree. I agree. I am quite a liberal, but I'm just interested. I mean, I'm sure you agree with me, lastly, Mr. Bowden, that anything that can be done to stop young people taking up cigarettes, well, sorry, within reason, anything that can be done should definitely be explored, if not implemented. And if you were, as a younger man, drawn to it because you saw there was just a sense that it was cool, or maybe you subliminally had been influenced by some advertising, doesn't that support what they're trying to do here?
Well, I think the key aspect of what you said is within reason, and that's a crucial thing. I don't think that trying to stop young people taking up smoking justifies any kind of intervention. This is a fairly extraordinary move by government to essentially ban advertising on a certain topic and, to prevent them from displaying their brand as they wish, with actually very little idea. I mean, there's also, let's not forget, a kind of rogue outlaw quality to smoking. I mean, that's always been a huge amount of the appeal in recent years. So the idea that this is now, a good which is so serious it has to be portrayed in, this kind of big black packaging, a big plain packaging, I don't think will do very much to tell young people that this is a stupid habit to take up, really. I think that it gives it a certain dark glamour to it.
Dave Bowden, thank you. From the Institute of Ideas. Well, let's get out there on the streets. Let's get in and among the news agents and get with the smokers. LBC's reporter James Waterhouse is at, I think, a tobacconist or news agent in central London. James, what are people saying?
Morning, Nick. Yes, well, people are sort of giving me mixed reviews. I've had a little walk down from Baker Street down to Leicester Square, back up through Soho, and I've tried to keep a tally of how many smokers I came across, and I lost count at around 40. A couple of news agents told me that they weren't sure it would work. In fact, if anything, they would be confused by plain packaged cigarettes when customers came in. But here on LBC, we're no stranger to a bit of an experimentation. I've got a cigarette, a pack of 10 in front of me, and I've wrapped the receipt that I got with them around so they can't be branded, and I've asked people whether they buy them. Say if they all look like that on the shelf, so they weren't branded at all, what do you think? Would you buy that at all?
Not at all.
Why not?
Yeah. No marketing at all.
And why do you want the marketing?
It's the brand of the cigarette, really.
So if the government was to make all cigarette packets look like that, do you think it would stop young people smoking?
It would have a factor, I would imagine.
If they all look like that, do you think it would stop a teenager coming in and taking up the habit?
It might stop... It possibly could, maybe teenagers, but people who already smoke, it's not going to do any different.
You look all excited there. Why?
Well, my husband smokes, and we've got two kids, so, yeah, anything that stops them thinking about taking up the habit. So it's got the packaging, kids recognise it. If it was all plain, then it would be good.
Do you know what? I don't think it'd make that much difference, if I'm really honest. I think if you want to smoke, you want to smoke.
Yeah, it's the cigarette, not the brand.
Yeah. So I think it'd make a big difference to revenues, to taxes, to tobacco companies.
Personally, me, I go for the cheapest, so I don't go for a brand.
When did you start smoking?
First cigarette, I was 9 years old, and I'm 62 and a half now.
So, cast your mind back. Can you remember what made you keep coming back for more when you were a teenager?
Keeping up with my brothers.
So, interesting there, Nick, only one woman referenced the tobacco companies losing out. Some people thought it would work, some people thought it wouldn't, but not much sympathy for the tobacco companies.
James, thank you. I've never heard an adult say 62 and a half. That's normally children say, I'm 8 3/4 or I'm 7 1/3 or whatever. But that gentleman smoking since the age of 9, as if that wasn't weird enough. And he's now 62 and a half. OK, what was it that made you first reach for the evil weed? Perhaps you can say, I gave it up. I'm so pleased I haven't smoked now. For 5 years, I've done really, really well. Would the packaging make any difference? And on the subject of money, as one of the contributors there said to LBC reporter James Waterhouse, as they said, the money that is brought in. How much money do you suppose smokers pour in to the exchequer? How much does the tax take from tobacco? Joe's in Hillingdon. What was it, Joe?
Hello, Nick. Morning.
Hello.
When I was growing up, I started smoking at the age of about 10 3/4. Oh, I'm only joking. I was about 10, 11 years old. Me and all my friends, we all started smoking.
Oh, sorry, you got me there for a minute. That was very good. That's after that man's 62 and a half. Yeah, 10, yeah, go on. Yeah.
Well, it is, mate. When we was all growing up, it was all to do with the brand and the packet. We didn't know what the sort of tar that was getting put into the or the nicotine levels or anything like that. It was all to do with the box colour And me, well, when we was all young.
What brand were you attracted to? You're allowed to tell me because it is pertinent to the conversation.
Yeah, we used to, when we first started smoking, we all wanted like Lambert and Butler. I think there was like a silver and bluey sort of colour, but that sort of thing. I think
because the colours just look cool. Is that what it was?
Yeah, well, I think as you grow up, I don't think it matters now when you're an adult, but definitely if you're a young smoker, especially because you look at the back behind the cabinet of where all the sweets were. Obviously, you used to see the cabinet for the cigarettes, and you always wondered what they were.
Mm.
And I think, yeah, it was to do with that. Like, I think it would definitely stop young smokers if you changed the thing. Because I think if I would have come into a shop and I would have seen just plain boxes at 11, 12 years old,
well,
I would never have wondered what they were. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know if you've been to the customer service area of a supermarket lately, and there's absolutely no reason that you do need to go, but they're behind fairly large screens or doors now. They have to keep the cigarettes.
Yeah, I have noticed that recently. Yeah, it's like sliding in doors now, so that definitely will help as well.
And
but
that's got to come into all sweet shops and newsagents soon as well. So, I mean, the point is, it is not illegal to smoke. What is the next thing that someone's going to have to ring a bell, almost like a leper, and say, unclean, unclean, I want a packet of cigarettes? If people want to do it, we should encourage them not to, but if they want to do it, should we make it this difficult, lastly?
Well, I think if adults are smoking, they know where the cigarettes are, they know what brand they smoke, but colour of the box is not going to change up, and I think it's just good for young smokers that's going to take it up. Do you know what I mean? It's definitely going to stop young smokers.
Thanks for that, Joe. 10, 11-ish when you took it up. By the way, I asked you just before the news headlines, what is the amount of income derived from people using tobacco? It's obviously cigarettes, pipe tobacco, cigars. £12.3 billion is levied. £12.3 billion. And that's enough to keep the health service going for, well, almost a month, or just over a month, actually. It's a lot of money, isn't it?
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
One word, Ebola. Just before Christmas, you were ringing me in your droves, telling me how frightened you were. Bob Geldof was touring the radio and television stations, in some cases using four-letter words to insist we had to buy more copies of that dreary song he put together. A number of mostly clapped-out pop and rock stars came together to lend their name for the charity because they thought it was going to be the new big thing. And never wanting to say I told you so, but I... Well, you can finish it off. What is it about us that we have to scare ourselves to this degree? Do you remember avian flu? We were all going to die with that. Planes were going to fall out of the skies with the millennium bug. And I am not for one second minimising the impact of Ebola. It's tragic that 21,724 people have been infected, of whom, even more sadly, 8,641 people have died. But it was nothing like the global pandemic, epidemic, plague that everyone said. Why, oh why, do we get ourselves into this situation? Why am I saying this? Because the World Health Organization itself agrees there's been a turning point in the Ebola crisis. Cases falling in the three affected countries, I remind you, they are Sierra Leone, Liberia and Guinea. Just 8 cases detected in Liberia in the last week, down from a peak of 500 back in September. The World Health Organization, WHO, says it's most promising, but, and quite rightly, they're still urging caution and highlighting the need to find anyone who's come into contact with Ebola patients. So why did we do it? Those breathless reports from correspondents on the Ebola front line, the record that was put out, as I say, by Bob Geldof, the calls that you said, this is going to be appalling, it's going to get hold in the West. Nurses being quarantined in various European countries, panic on the television stations. Nothing. Nothing. Again, desperately sad, 8,641 people died. But guess what? In Britain, 30,000 people will die this winter. Elderly and vulnerable people will die this winter, in part because they can't afford to heat their homes. Dr. Sheena Cruikshank is an immunology specialist at the University of Manchester and joins me now. We do seem to like to frighten ourselves, don't we, Doctor?
Well, yes, but I think Ebola was frightening. So we'd never seen, Ebola was a very rare disease with maybe 100 cases a year. We'd never seen it expand in this way. And perhaps we could have stopped some of the fatalities if we'd responded a little bit earlier. Because the great thing, for all you're saying about scaremongering, the great thing about the response from the UK and the World Health Organization and all the nations is that we got healthcare and health education out to the countries that needed it. And it's really that response, I think, that's been responsible for the decline in this disease that we've seen this week, which is just fantastic news.
Yes, obviously it's fantastic news. And, of course, people's lives are spared. We celebrate that. But in part, is it fair to say that these three countries, because of various practices, not least the idea that families like to wash the bodies of the deceased, in part this has been a tragic crisis, but somewhat of their own making?
No, I don't think that's fair. This is a virus that is contracted. And the source of the virus is fruit bats. Mm-hmm. So they've tracked the original source of this particular outbreak, and it appears to be from children playing in an area, in a tree, where the fruit bats happen to be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's unfortunate, really. And fruit bats are very common. So what it flags up to us is that we need to be more vigilant, and we need to create a sort of bigger wave of understanding about these diseases and have strategies.
Well, surely that's beholden on the three.
Happening.
Yeah, that's doctor. That's beholden on the three companies in three countries. I'm sorry, involved, isn't it?
Pardon me.
That is beholden on the three countries involved to do that education. Surely.
Well, you would say that, but we've got two countries that have just emerged from a brutal civil war. They're living on less than a pound a day, and the whole health infrastructure has been destroyed. So it's very difficult to get that education. You've got lots of people who live in rural communities who just don't get access to health workers at all. So trying to get that kind of information out to people who have no experience of sort of modern healthcare is quite challenging, and that's been one of the challenges people have faced.
Doctor, lastly, if we look back at some of the grave warnings at the peak of the crisis, it was almost implied, it was certain it would get into the West, it would come to Europe, it would get to the US. Fortunately, it does not appear to have done so. Why is that?
I think it's because we've taken it very seriously. We've tracked it and we've trained people. So obviously we've had a few cases in the West of the health workers that have come here. But because of the training that's been received by the health workers and the readiness, we've been able to contain the virus, because the virus is relatively difficult to catch. And, you know, what we saw where there were sort of minor breaches, as in Dallas, that meant that there were few extra cases. But again, vigilance meant that we could contain it. And
Dr. Sheena Cruikshank, thank you for your time, Dr. Immunology Specialist at the University of Manchester, 13 after 8. Listening is André Hellers, Head of Programmes for Médecins Sans Frontières, who indeed was in Sierra Leone as recently as last month. Was this crisis in any way, now that we look back, overplayed?
Absolutely not. Certainly not overplayed. I mean, if anything, Médecins Sans Frontières' message all along was that it was underplayed, and not taken seriously enough for long enough, and that's why it got as bad as it did.
I mean, tragically, 8,641 people have so far succumbed to this condition, but 30,000 people die each winter in Britain because they can't afford the heat.
Well, yeah, of course, but at the same time, those are also the registered deaths. There's a lot of people who lost their lives in areas where they were never able to get registered with the WHO statistics. And what's more than the thousands of people who died from the Ebola virus itself is you have an entire healthcare system, or what was left of one, or what was ever there in the first place, that completely collapsed. And you have people, women who have obstructed labor, who require a doctor to deliver a baby safely. You have malaria, you have everything else. And that's untold numbers of lives that have been lost beyond what the Ebola virus itself
is. 30,000. How confident are you that some of the practices that sadly exist in countries such as this, like washing the bodies of dead relatives, which obviously can lead to infection, have they been completely finished now? Has it been advised not to do that anymore?
Well, I think everyone's got the message. And honestly, I think behavioral adaptation among the population is one of the main reasons why it seems to be that we're turning the corner on this at this point in time. So, yeah, I think that at this point, a lot of people got the message. regarding anyone who would have died of any kind of sickness that might have resembled Ebola. But it's difficult to say if everyone got the message everywhere, you know.
Indeed. Well done to you and all the staff who work at Médecins Sans Frontières, an extraordinary organisation. André Heller's your head of programmes. And now over to you. I'm sure it's me, and I make no excuse for banging on about this. I'm coming back to that figure again. 8,641 known deaths to Ebola. Absolutely tragic. Not saying it's not for a second. Now under control. Pop stars running around singing songs, government pledging money, people flying out there, TV reporters giving breathless dispatches on the Ebola front line, driving out in trucks, watching as corpses are taken off in the back of ambulances. It's terrible, terrible stuff. Meanwhile, in this country, I'm going to say it again, I don't give a damn about you, 30,000 elderly and vulnerable people will die this winter, in part because they can't afford the heat. Is it me, or have we got this whole thing the wrong way around? Mike in Birmingham, your reaction, you're on the radio, good morning.
Hi, Nick. I don't really agree with what you're saying about the, comparing the 30,000 people that may die from cold in winter in England this winter.
Right.
I think, I think the guy from MSF was saying that, you know, he was including the fact that, you know, there's the knock-on effect from Ebola deaths. You know, there's farmers have stopped working because they couldn't go out. They didn't want to go out into the fields because of the danger of catching Ebola. And you're talking about there's children have been orphaned. There's people afraid to go to hospitals. I mean, the secondary effects are huge, I think, from the Ebola crisis. And I think you're definitely underplaying it.
Why?
When you say...
Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Why what?
Why am I underplaying it? Do you know how many people will die of flu in the United States this year?
Yeah, but Nick...
300,000. 300,000 will die of flu in the US. Now, some of those will be elderly, I grant you.
Yeah.
It's tragic. 8,641 died in total of Ebola. Where are the songs for people dying of flu in America?
But, Nick, you're not considering the fact that that's 8,000 people in the space of a year... Just from Ebola alone, and that's with an international response.
Mm.
So that's with the whole, supposedly the whole world caring.
Mm.
Now imagine if the whole world hadn't done anything.
Well, only 21,000 people caught it. I say only in
yeah,
in
that's
quotes.
Only with the international response.
Well,
so do you understand what I'm saying? Like, so
this was supposedly the trouble was, Mike. Respectfully, the whole world, and I sense you, got caught up a little bit by that movie with Dustin Hoffman in it, which is a great film called Outbreak, where this little monkey, it's called Outbreak, and this little monkey's jumping around some American town and it bites somebody, I can't remember, and the whole city's about to be wiped out because Donald Sutherland goes completely bonkers and wants to blow up the town. And it's a very good Hollywood treatment. And I think people like you, much as I respect you and your views, thought, oh, my God, this is what we have here. And it wasn't. It was never going to be. 22,000. I'm there now. 22,000 cases. Tragic. 8,600 die. Absolutely awful. Nothing like the rate they were talking about. You were conned, Mike. Just accept. Just agree.
I don't think I was.
You were, no,
I don't
just
think
say
I was
conned. Just agree
no,
that you were conned. You can't help it, but you were conned.
I didn't see that video. I didn't even see that video, Nick.
Okay.
So how could I be conned by that video? I wasn't watching what I was...
You were conned by the world media.
No, I wasn't.
You were.
I mean, at what point do you start caring about a crisis? At what point do you start caring?
I could say at what point you start caring about a crisis in Britain where all these people die. Sorry, I can answer a question with a question.
Well, I mean, the thing is, for me, you're ignoring the fact that was with that entire response.
Mm.
That still 8,000 people died, right? With that entire response.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about this. You're not talking about the secondary deaths. You're not talking about the deaths as a result of people who can't get access to hospitals because the Ebola crisis has stopped the hospitals from taking on more people.
Mm-hmm.
You're not talking about the doctors who have died because and the health systems that are now in crisis because they've lost so many doctors.
Mm. Right. All right, okay. Mike, thank you. You stood your corner really well.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
The government has taken the unprecedented step of writing to every mosque in the country to tell Muslim leaders they must do more to root out the men of hate who were preaching extremism. Eric Pickles, the community secretary, community's secretary, has written to over 1,000 imams and other Islamic leaders, urging them to tell young Muslims they should be proud to be British. Whitehall is unable to defeat jihadist ideology alone. Muslim leaders have a responsibility to prevent young men and women from being radicalised, is contained in the letter that was sent out on Friday. Let's speak with Lord Ahmed of Wimbledon, who is a communities minister, who joins me now. What are you hoping to achieve with that letter, Lord Ahmed?
Well, good morning, Nick.
Morning, sir.
What we're looking to do, I mean, the letter focuses on sort of three key issues. First of all, was the unequivocal condemnation from across the board, all communities, all faiths, and the Muslim community was part and parcel of this at the front line, on the front foot, demonstrably showing the rejection and the unequivocal condemnation of those heinous crimes we saw in Paris. Secondly, was a level of reassurance. Both myself and Eric Pickles have engaged extensively, along with Theresa May, with communities, both the Muslim community and the Jewish community, about possible, you know, the reprisals from the attacks. And we've been working very closely with the police. And the letter also gives that, underlines that reassurance. And the third element, which you focused in on the introduction, was how we can work together to get rid of and eradicate this extremism. Time and time again, and I'm a Muslim myself, this has nothing to do with Islam, it has nothing to do with faith, and the people who carry out these crimes are criminals, and we need to be loud and clear in eradicating this from our society. And we want to, as the letter says quite clearly, work with all communities to ensure we eradicate this and work together with the Muslim community to address these issues, you know, sort of front on. And we, there's no other way of dealing with it.
Yes. How will you know what the letter might achieve?
Well, you don't, do you? When you send out a letter, you send it out on the basis that I've outlined. I'm disappointed by the response of the Muslim Council of Britain on this. They said about we have to restate somehow Muslim values with British values. Well, the letter's quite explicit. There's a paragraph which says British values are Muslim values. It reads, we believe together we have an opportunity to demonstrate the true nature of British Islam today. In the letter, both Eric and I thank explicitly the Muslim community for what they're doing, but we also are responding to what the Muslim communities tell them ourselves, that we need to work collaboratively on this to ensure that we address the root out, the real causes of extremism. And I fully accept this is not just about the imams. We see issues on the internet, for example, and we're working closely with the Muslim community on that. We have an initiative called Imams Online to counter the extremist narrative, positive elements of the Muslim community coming out explicitly saying, not in our name, and we need to hear more of that.
Lord Ahmed, hold on the line, if you would, because I have someone from the Muslim Council of Britain, just to illustrate those points a little more for my listeners. Welcome to the conversation, Harun Khan, who's Deputy Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain. You have concerns over this letter, I understand, Mr. Khan. What are they? Good morning.
Good morning. I mean, firstly, on behalf of the Muslim Council of Britain, I think just to reiterate that in terms of condemnation of terrorism and, you know, violent acts, we've been consistent throughout many years condemning these acts. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the comments, to be fair, our response in the media was in response to a request from the BBC yesterday as to what Eric Pickles was quoted as saying. Mm-hmm. With regard to mosques. Now, us being a national umbrella organisation representing around 500 mosques and Islamic organisations, we haven't seen this letter. No one in government has actually spoken to us. In fact, the community secretary, who's been in position for more than 4 years, hasn't really engaged with us.
I don't understand. If you are a representative of 500 mosques, why wouldn't one of the imams there let you have sight of the letter?
Well, I mean, I think if the letter is making reference to leaders of the community, so obviously we're not seen as leaders of the community, and you know we've not been privy to this information, so but we can only comment on things that we haven't seen.
We're talking on
a second-hand basis.
But
Mr. Khan, if we had the letter, then we would have the right to respond.
But Mr. Khan, respectfully, sir, surely this issue is of such import that whether you were or whether you were not, or whether you're accidentally omitted from the list of who should be in receipt of the letter, it falls to you and the Council of Britain, the Muslim Council of Britain, to go to a mosque and get, not to row about whether they sent you a letter, to talk about what the letter's actually intending to achieve.
It just reinforces the viewpoint that mosques are the problem. But in our view, mosques are actually the solution. You know, mosques are not the ones where extremism is breeding.
Well, I don't know. That's why I have to reflect. You're at the front line here, sir. That's why I ask you. So you think, in a way, I mean, I think this is perhaps more germane than whether or not you received a letter, frankly. You think, in fact, that writing to Mosk is a bit of a fruitless exercise.
Yeah, it is. Because it's not just fruitless, Nick. I think the key point is that a letter of this nature, in this public nature, is implying that there is an issue with the mosques and extremism is breeding there. That is not the case. I think, you know, we've done so much in the last 2 weeks since the attacks in Paris in terms of not only condemnation, we've held meetings, we've had interfaith groups, we've met with Jewish leaders, you know, giving our solidarity towards them in terms of what we can do collectively. And I think that's the right approach.
All right, stay on the line if you would. Let me bring Lord Ahmad, the Communities Minister, back into the conversation. What about this idea that perhaps the mosques aren't the problem, Lord? They are actually the solution.
Well, I agree with that. You know,
well, why write to them then?
No, why we're writing with them is because the Muslim community says to us time and time again, I'm a Muslim myself, about how we can work together collaboratively into addressing the issues of extremism. I think it's somewhat naive of the MCB to start criticising our letter without seeing it. And as you rightly pointed out, this has gone directly to imams because we believe that working directly with people who may come across people, youngsters who may be misguided or are being, turning to an extremist ideology because of what they see on the internet. One of the first people they will go to is the imam. One of the first people they'll go to for clarification of what Islam says is the imam. So we have to deal with people and work together with them. There's them and us. As the letter says from both Eric and I, British values are Muslim values. And right at the end of the letter, and this is something that the MCB should also respond to if they feel so strongly about it, we've said, and quite clearly, I don't know how more explicit, Nick, we can get, we said, we welcome your thoughts, ideas and initiatives on how to ensure that true Islam's true message of peace triumphs over those who seek to divide our communities. Thank you for your positive work and we look forward to working with you and continuing to work with you in the future. Our position in government is very clear. We welcome people who are on the front line, who are dealing with these issues day to day. At one point we're hearing from the MCB that mosques are in the front line and they're part of the solution, and then they're saying don't write to them.
Well, let's put that now, just hold on the line if you would. That would seem a very good point, Haran Khan, Deputy Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain. It may be that I'm going to say young men, they normally are radicalised over the internet, but then they seek out an imam. That is the importance, surely, of this letter.
It's not, Nick. I'm somebody who's born and brought up in this country. Okay, I've been to mosques throughout my entire life from a young age, and also I'm also part of a mosque management as well locally in my area. We haven't seen the letter, and anyway, it's not just the letter itself. I think the key point is that we're saying actually young people aren't going to imams for help. They're, because of the constant legislation and the clampdown on mosques and imams over the number of years through anti-terrorism. Imams aren't allowed to speak out. What is it that young people want to say? They want to talk about issues that they have. They've got anger. They've got issues around foreign policy. You know, we hear this many times.
Ah, well, if you hear it, that's exactly what this letter's about, isn't it?
Yeah, but the point is,
if I suddenly present myself, I change my identity, I discover Islam and I'm a real problem and I go to my nearest mosque, that's exactly what the government's driving at. They need to be told by the nearest mosque to Blackheath. I don't know where it would be.
They won't do it.
Well, they must, respectfully, they must do it. Surely, that's what this letter's about.
No, they won't, because they know that if it'll be treated as a suspect way of doing things. So if it comes from the government in this way, to mosques and etc., that basically if you come to us, then, you know, it's almost like, you know, you're being watched.
All right, last word, I think, must go to the Communities Minister, Lord Ahmad. Good intent, but I fear you might be knocking on a closed door briefly, Lord.
No, Ahmad. I don't. You know, when you have noble intent, perseverance is the key. And he talked about young men. Only recently we've seen what a great man Amir Khan is, who stands for Britain, who wears the flag on his heart, on his sleeve, whatever, on his boxing glove. And what did he say? I'm proud to be Muslim, I'm proud to be British, and when my religion is hijacked by fanatics, I stand up to fight against that. And I think that's what we want to see more of.
I must leave it there, Lord Ahmad, your Communities Minister. I think you mean Amir Khan is the boxer to whom you're referring. Thank you. Harun Khan, thank you, Deputy Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain. A letter. Is it enough? To other news, if you've got a diesel car, get ready to pay more to park, at least in one London borough, for that parking pass that you need. It's in Islington, where it's been announced that they reckon more than 9,000 diesel car drivers will pay an extra £100 each year for the privilege of parking outside their home. It's effectively a diesel tax. I think it comes in later this year. Councillor Claudia Webb is executive member for the environment at Islington Council, joins me now. What's the thinking behind this, Councillor? Good morning.
Well, good morning, Nick. Our difficulty here is the public health issues that are associated with diesel vehicles. Our concern is nitrogen dioxide and particulate matters, where these are considered to be harmful to health. Diesels, if you like, have been almost proven to cause much of this problem when it comes to these pollutants, and are causing the health problems of our residents, causing cancer and other heart issues like heart and lung diseases and other health and long-term issues, and even death in Islington. So our issue is to try to tackle these problems by tackling the most polluting vehicles, and that is proven to us to be diesel vehicles. Now, and we want to provide a useful deterrent.
Mm. Is it fair to bring it in retrospectively? How fair is that? That is to say, it wasn't that long ago that central government and City Hall was urging people to buy diesel cars. Now it's been found that that decision was wrong. Indeed, Boris Johnson, the mayor, has apologised a number of occasions on this programme for information. It wasn't on his watch, but he appreciates people went out, bought diesel cars. Now, they're not easy to change. Why should people do that when they were actually following a guidance?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, we it's unfortunate in a sense for vehicle owners that have been lured into buying diesel cars as being sort of more healthier, more safer than petrol vehicles, but the evidence base is not there for that.
No, we know now. But your constituents, your residents, I'm sorry, went out in all good faith, some of them possibly because they were advised by Centre, and we've got all the information here. Ken Livingstone, the then mayor, saying diesel cars were better. Now the evidence has changed. Why should they have to pay the financial price?
Well, as a responsible local authority, we have to be concerned about the damaging health
that's not in dispute. Surely it should be. It can't be retrospective.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Now, some of you may recall, during Call Clegg a couple of weeks ago, we took a call from Michelle in Islington regarding her 8-year-old son who'd been expelled from school, later diagnosed with ADHD and sent to a pupil referral unit. However, as a working parent, she was having trouble with the hours they were offering. Here's a little of what she told the Deputy Prime Minister.
The timetable for this pupil referral unit is 9.15 to 2.45, and on a Thursday it's 9.15 to 12.15. So how, as full-time working parents, are we supposed to get to the school, the pupil referral unit, at 2.45?
Well, just to show that we at LBC and with the help of the Deputy Prime Minister's Office, we have now taken this up. A lot of you emailed and asked, and Islington Borough Council spokesman has come back. They have now moved the hours. They are working with the pupil referral unit. We have put that together. So hopefully the best of luck, Michelle, with your young chap, and we hope it all works out.
That's very good news.
Nick Clegg, where do we go now, sir?
Ben in Edinburgh. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
Hi, Ben.
I'd like to ask, should we lower the voting age? Because
yes.
I'm 17 and I voted in the Scottish referendum last September, but I won't be able to vote in the UK general election. Mm. And it's very annoying.
Yeah.
Can I ask, this is Nick Ferrari, which way might you vote, Ben? You don't have to answer, of course.
A Liberal Democrat, of course.
Let's see what Nick Clegg makes of your suggestion.
Ah, Ben, now why don't you stay on the air for a good while? How nice to hear from you. No, Ben, I basically agree with you, of course.
We don't want to intrude. This is quite a rare event. Nick Clegg's found a voter. I'll step out the room.
Won't let go of you now, Ben. I basically entirely agree with you. I've long been of the view that we should be lowering the voting age. And I think for those who believe that we shouldn't, and as you know, we haven't been able to make progress on this in the coalition government because David Cameron and the Conservatives don't want to give 16 and 17-year-olds the vote. I think for those who, you know, still sort of digging their heels in and sort of defending the old way of doing things, just look at your experience and many, many people like you who were fully engaged in animated the referendum debate, It's your country. It's your future. It's quite right that you should have a say about the future of your country. It shouldn't just be allowed, you know, just left to others to decide it for you. Now, as you know, what we've decided to do is to give to the government of Scotland the freedom to decide to lower the voting age for elections in Scotland. So you will at least, I think, assuming that that is then a decision which will be, or a freedom that will, or a new power that will be acted upon by the Scottish Government, you will have that right north of the border. But look, the Labour Party now agrees with lowering the voting age. We've long believed in it. I think the Conservative Party is out of step with modern times. I think it will happen, Ben, so keep making the case.
All right, let's just go to some emails briefly before we go to the last couple of calls. Dan in Dartford. How are we meant to have any confidence in the Lib Dem Party when one of their own, Matthew Oakeshott, has given £300,000 to ensure Labour candidates get in the next general election? What would Nick Clegg say to him?
Well, he's, as it happens, he's not a Liberal Democrat. He's a very wealthy man, and he's in a sense free to. I think
he was a Lib Dem, wasn't he?
He's
a Lib
Dem. He was. But he's left the party. So he's a wealthy. He made a lot of money in property, and he's giving. I don't know what it is.
£300,000
to Labour, £300,000 to Liberal Democrat. I think he's even giving some money to the Green MP.
Yes, £10,000 to the Greens.
I mean, he's not a member of my party, so he's free to decide what to do with his considerable wealth.
Yeah, doesn't help you there, does it?
Well, it helps those Lib Dem MPs he's helping.
But not the Labour.
It's a free country. He's not a member of the party, and he's a very wealthy man, and he can do what he likes with his cash.
We go to other calls.
Ray in Broadstairs.
Morning, Mr. Clegg.
Morning.
Given your assertion that the suggestion of, courtesy of the national polls, that the Lib Dems will lose half of their seats is silly in public school speak, would you be prepared to put your money where your mouth is, in the sense that I'm prepared to make a wager on a 10-to-1 basis, and we will give the proceeds to a family in Sierra Leone that I've supported through the Ebola crisis. I'm prepared to pay £200 to them if you get 25 seats or more. You're so convinced that you aren't going to lose your seats, I'm asking you to be prepared publicly to donate £2,000, that's the 10-to-1 basis, to that village in Sierra Leone, in the event of you actually retaining the seats that you are so confident of getting. Are you so confident and so brave, and you're certainly rich enough, I know, to be able to afford that? Are you prepared to do that publicly?
So, Ray, I think if I start, placing money bets with you, then there'll be no end of people who will be asking me to do the same thing. So if you don't mind, Ray... by the way, I think it's great that you give that money to that family in Sierra Leone, and I hope you'll continue to do so. But, Ray, look, I'll tell you the reason why, and I'm sorry if you felt the word silly was wrong, OK? Wrong. Why I think some of these predictions are wrong is what they do is they take these snapshot polls, which vary, of course, massively. I mean, the way in which they're arrived at, the calculations, are sort of very variable. But what they do is they take a snapshot of the whole country. And, of course, there are large parts of the country. I mean, I've never denied this. There are large parts of the country where we're not kind of on the ground, we're not knocking on people's doorsteps, we're not present in people's lives, where we have been knocked back because of the difficult decisions we've had to take and because some people don't like the fact that we stepped up to the plate in the first place. But in those areas, and this is why I am confident we can do so much better than this endless sort of cottage industry of punditry suggests, and not least, by the way, because I spend so much more time in those seats than any of those pundits, is because where we get out and we explain to people that, look, we've got this big choice as a country to finish the job of securing an economic recovery, but doing it fairly, and we're the party that's saying we're going to cut less than the Conservatives, but borrow less than Labour, because we don't believe you need to swing left or right like those parties are doing. We've got to stay the course and deal with our debts and our deficit, but then fund public services properly. When we set out that and set out all the great things we've done on taxes and pensions and apprenticeships, we actually retain a lot of support. And that, of course, that's not picked up on a kind of great big sort of national snapshot poll. So look, that's why I'm confident. But I'm not a sophologist. I'm not a soothsayer. I'm not a number cruncher. I'm a leader of a campaigning political party, and I'm itching to get out on the campaign trail because my experience is that where we get our message across, actually people are prepared to continue to give us their support.
All right, Florence in Orpington says, I've read in The Guardian this morning that secret talks have gone on about the leaders' debates. What can Nick Clegg tell us? Are they going to happen?
Well, if they're so secret, Florence, that I'm not aware... What, with the political parties?
Yes.
I'm not aware of any great secret talks. So we're still not with me. So I'm getting really paranoid now. So Florence, who has been having these secret talks without me?
But you're ready to go, whatever the equation might
well,
be.
Well, no. Actually, as it happens, I wasn't very happy with the original proposal or the proposal that the part the broadcasters put forward, because I'm the leader of a governing party, and I want to be held to account beyond everything else for what we've done in government for the last 5 years. I think I have an old-fashioned view that if you run government or help run government, you should be held to account. I don't understand why David Cameron doesn't believe in that simple principle. And actually, I would have been excluded from one of the debates. So the broadcasters got a difficult job, but they absolutely shouldn't be bamboozled or intimidated by this almost comic game playing from the Conservatives who've developed this really, you know, truly touching concern about the plight of the Green Party.
It's in his heart, you can tell. Talking of the Prime Minister, he was asked by a radio station yesterday if he had to take a group of world leaders to a meal, would he go to Gordon Ramsay, Nando's or a Harvester? You're probably aware what he asked. I want to change it slightly. He opted for Nando's.
Oh, I would have done.
I want to change it.
There might be differences.
If you took your fellow world leaders, would it be Nando's, a Gordon Ramsay, a Harvester or a tapas bar?
Well. Can I speak up for the Swedish meatball wrap that Pret do?
Come out of left field, but you can, yes.
Yeah, well, this would be for lunch, would it?
Yeah, it's a bit of lunch.
Yeah, well, that's quite a staple diet for me, and I like it.
What is that, a Swedish meatball?
It's a meatball wrap. It's try it.
Okay, and how much does that cost?
Ooh, dearie me. I can't remember. I've been stumped on the price. I better go rush out and find out.
Do you have staff who buy it for
you? No, but I also buy some soup and sometimes. I will disaggregate.
How do you like your eggs in the morning? Just before you go, can you solve the biggest political riddle of our time? At that cabinet meeting, I'm going to play you some tracks. Which one was it? Was it this by Beyoncé? You must not know about me. You must not know about me. Or was it this by Beyoncé?
No, it wasn't that. I would have recognised that.
Or was it this by Beyoncé?
I reckon it was the first.
This is
Michael Gove.
This is Michael Gove, we're trying to get to the bottom.
Let's
play Go Back to Number One again, if we could, Clive. Is this what you heard when Michael goes and he got a public grilling? Shellacking.
I think it was this one, but I can't quite remember. I was so nonplussed by all that. I didn't know where it was. Look, I have a BlackBerry, which my ringtone is famously called factory setting ringtone. I didn't even know how to change mine. I was gobsmacked that Michael Gove should even know.
Didn't think that was a kind of music, did you? Factory setting, a bit like garage.
Yeah, exactly. I thought, this cool track called factory setting.
Great having there. We are getting to the bottom of all the big political stories here on Call Clegg with Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
50 years ago, Winston Churchill died. And now his grandson is marking that anniversary by launching a £6,000 prize to cement the wartime leader's legacy as a founding father of the European Union. But let's go back to perhaps the darkest of the dark days of that time. And he probably was a man who was born for the time. And we were going to play you some Winston Churchill. The machine has failed there, has it? Can we try again?
The British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields. And in the streets, we shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Well, I don't know about you, but that makes the hairs on my back of my neck go up even now. What it must have been like to be listening to that live at that time. I appreciate you would be of a certain age now, but my God, that impact had impact. London Mayor Boris Johnson, of course, has written a best-selling book, The Churchill Factor, was speaking to me earlier in the show from Kurdistan. Yes, you did hear that correctly. We'll park that for now. I asked him, where would the world have been without Winston Churchill?
I think there's absolutely no doubt that if he hadn't been there, Nick, in that cabinet meeting in May 1940, Britain would almost certainly have made an accommodation with evil in the form of Nazism, and Europe would have been consigned to darkness and to barbarism, and it would have been utterly catastrophic. So I think that the world owes not just success in the Second World War to Winston Churchill, but also we owe him the 70 years of peace and prosperity that has succeeded that victory in 1944 and 1945. So I think without Churchill, the world would have been a dark and bitter place, and particularly the European continent.
So, how would the world have looked without him? Let's turn to John Hughes Wilson, who's an Archives Fellow of Churchill College in Cambridge, an author and broadcaster specialising in military and defence affairs, joins me now. It's that question, if I can, sir. What would the world look like? Good morning.
Nick, good morning. I totally agree with Boris. The world would have been a much darker place. And one of the difficult things to get our heads around today is that when Churchill comes to power on the 10th of May 1940, he's a very, very unpopular figure in Westminster, in Whitehall, in politics. And he has enormous difficulty overcoming the gang that really wants to give in and sign a separate peace. And a lot of people have ignored that, or it's become forgotten. But people like Halifax and Simon, and even Rab himself, were actually trying to do a deal through Sweden that we'd come to a compromise deal with Hitler. That would have been disastrous.
What gave him the strength to carry on, Mr. Hughes Wilson?
That's a good question. He is a remarkable individual with a great sense of his own worth. And he's got...
No, we're not talking about Boris Johnson now.
Well, maybe Boris is modelling himself on the great man.
Sorry, do go on.
But you're quite right. But you have to have an enormous ego. And if you actually look at Churchill's childhood, he's an irritating little so-and-so. He's very full of himself. He must have been a very bumptious little boy. And he's quite unpopular with his colleagues because he's always thrusting himself forward. And as I say, he has this overriding sense of his own destiny, rather like Ataturk in Turkey in many ways. He's pushing himself forward. He has enormous self-confidence.
I can remember to this day, as a young chap, being told by my mum, who served in the police during World War II, and I was just doing some history and I was a young lad, that after the war, they actually voted Churchill out. How would he have felt about that? How did he reflect on that?
Well, Clementine said to him, because he was very old and tired and he'd had a lot of strokes, he'd had a terrible war in terms of the punishment on an old man's body and his faculties, he said, Clementine, his wife, said to him, well, maybe it's a blessing in disguise, dear, to which the great man said, reply, if it's a blessing, then it's a very well-disguised one, my love.
That's fantastic. We'll talk again, I sense, over this year of landmarks. John Hughes Wilson, thank you. Archives Fellow of the Churchill College in Cambridge, an author and broadcaster. And it's not just in Britain or even Europe that Churchill's fame is known. Let's go to the United States. Lee Pollock is Executive Director of the Churchill Center in Chicago, joins me now. How does the average American citizen, and I appreciate that's a weird kind of question, but how do they view Winston Churchill? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. Churchill has an immense following in the United States, and it could be argued that in some respects he's probably more popular and more lionized over here than even in Britain, although he is obviously, Britain's greatest son. Part of the reason for that is that a lot of the controversies that surround Churchill in Britain that relate to domestic politics are things that are not as salient here. The First World War, his time as Chancellor of the Exchequer in the 1920s, his relations with labor and the trade union movement aren't things that Americans necessarily have as much interest in. Now, of course, we as an organization tell the whole story about Churchill throughout his whole life, but Americans tend to know the image of Churchill as the great war leader, and that's what impresses itself most.
What do you do at the Churchill Center in Chicago, Mr. Pollock? What is there for folk to see?
The Churchill Center is actually an international member organization based here in the United States, but with members around the world. And we have a UK affiliate, the Churchill Center, that's actually run by one of John's colleagues at the Churchill Archive Center in Cambridge. And we publish a magazine. We have a wonderful website, winstonchurchill.org. We have conferences. The next one is actually in Britain at the end of May. And our members are people all around the world. Some are academic historians and some are lay people, and they're united by a common interest in this very interesting man.
So lastly, I'm going to ask you, and you'll know why I'm asking this, Mr. Pollock, do you have an active branch in Germany?
No, but we do have members there, and Winston Churchill believed in reconciliation and magnanimity, so even Germans find him a very interesting and significant character.
Thanks for staying up so, well, I was going to say late into the night. Actually, it's early in the morning for you to take the call and explaining to us the global appeal of Winston Churchill. LBC reporter James Waterhouse in and among the tourists of London asks what they knew about Winston Churchill. James joins me now. Where are you? What have you found out, James?
Nick, good morning. Yes, I went on the tourist hunt. I cut a lonely figure by the fountain at Piccadilly Circus. You would think it would be a hub for tourists, although it might be a bit early, and the minus one temperatures this morning might have scared a few away. But nevertheless, we are talking about the life of Winston Churchill 50 years on from his death. To some, he was a successful career politician and, of course, a charismatic leader that led the nation to victory over Nazi Germany. To others, he was a man with questionable views who made some poor decisions during his career. But that's the debate here. What do people outside of here think? So this morning, I've been asking tourists what Winston Churchill means to them.
Well, growing up in South Africa, we were not all that exposed to the politics in the United Kingdom, so it's a little bit tricky. Yeah, I think all in all, he was a great character by the looks of things.
Well, the big man from the UK in the times of the war, influencing the outcome of the war, signing the agreement at the end of the war, so all related to history.
What's the view over in Germany in terms of how history will judge him?
So he seemed positive.
Well, I'm from Ireland, so I wouldn't really know, to be totally honest with you. But in my history class, probably, I don't know, that I don't really know what he did.
We will fight them on the beaches.
On the beaches. All I know is Winston Churchill, lad. That's all. That's all I know of Winston Churchill.
Car insurance. Yeah, what Winston Churchill means to you.
That's all that I know.
The power of advertising. So, just a little insight there, Nick, of the views held by some from further shores, and they are certainly varied views, but we're still very much able to talk about Winston Churchill 50 years on.
Yeah, James, you were doing fine. My heart sunk. I'm not knocking the firm, but they know it for car insurance, and I think a nodding dog. Dear God. James Waterhouse is on the front line there, LBC's reporter. Thank you for that.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.